I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Sam Madeira back here on the Dr. Madeira Show. And today we have a very distinguished guest, Professor Kerry Bone. How are you doing today, Professor Bone?
Thank you, Sam. I'm doing very well. It's a beautiful morning here in Australia, where I live up in Queensland in the city of Warwick.
Excellent. Yeah, it's beautiful countryside there. I had the pleasure and honor of being a guest in Queensland and meeting you face-to-face back in July of this year. So that was spectacular.
Yes. Brilliant. Very impressed with the work you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's why I'm here. I don't do this for just anyone.
I appreciate that. I've been following your work, and I think the first book of yours, I either got my hands on it through my naturopathic doctor around 2003 or four, and then started purchasing all of your books in fall of 2005 when I was studying herbal sciences at Vassar University here in Seattle. So I've been a long time, I guess, fan. So this is pretty amazing for me to have you on the podcast at this point. I'm just going to introduce you with your bio to the audience, and everybody should know who you are. And if they don't, they will know. So for those of you who don't know, Professor Kerry Bone is the co-founder and innovation driver at MediHerb, which he serves as director of research and development. As a recognition of his role and in conjunction with his research colleagues, in 2016, MediHerb was awarded the American Botanical Council's Varro E. Tyler Award for Excellence in Phytomedicinal Research, which is another word for herbal research. As part of his educational role, Kerry is adjunct professor at New York Chiropractic College, providing input into their postgraduate applied nutrition program. He also founded the successful Masters of Health Science Herbal Medicine course at the University of New England in 2004 and served there as associate professor from 2004 to 2012. Kerry is co-author of
I should add, that's New England, Australia, too.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And Professor Kerry Bone is co-author of around 40 scientific papers on herbal research, including original research and systematic reviews. He currently serves as the only Australian member of the editorial board of the journal Phytomedicine, the top herbal medicine journal in the world, and is on the advisory board of the American Botanical Council, as also known as ABC. He has also written and co-written six popular textbooks on herbal medicine. His most recent with Simon Mills, the second edition of Principles and Practice of Phytotherapy, which was awarded the 2013 James A. Duke Excellence in Botanical Literature Award by the ABC, which is the second time these authors have received this distinguished award, which is amazing. He still maintains a busy herbal and naturopathic practice in Toowoomba. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, that's good.
Toowoomba, Queensland, where he has been in continuous service for 34 years. So it's really an honor to have you on the podcast. And like I said, I mean, any naturopathic doctor in the United States or North America really has been using your textbooks, your botanical medicine books in their programs in medical school, in naturopathic medical school here in the States. And, you know, your work is well respected around the world. And you were just in the U.S. doing a tour with several other phytotherapists from Australia around California and some other states, I believe in the Southwest and other places,
that's right.
Correct?
Yeah, I went to Dallas as well. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah.
So and we had wonderful numbers, you know, mid-200s in Los Angeles, mid-300s in San Francisco. So a lot of our colleagues, it's great to see them come and want to learn from us and appreciate our work and dialogue with us.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was actually at the one in the San Francisco area, and it was a huge space that you were speaking in, and I think over around 350 people in the audience, doctors and practitioners. So you're a well-known speaker in the natural health space and, you know, functional herbal medicine space. So it's an honor to, you know, hear you speak and have you on the podcast, as I already mentioned. So let's kind of get into some of the, maybe the origin real briefly, kind of what brought you into natural medicine as a naturopath and phytotherapist in Australia, and then how MediHerb originated.
Okay, well just very quickly, I was working as a research scientist, and I was in an interesting field. I was actually looking at the environmental impact of coal-fired power stations, not specifically carbon dioxide emissions at that point. When you're talking here, the early 1970s. So not so much of that aspect as I was looking at heavy metal pollution that followed from and mineral pollution from coal-fired power stations. And, you know, I was developing myself in the field and publishing and what have you. And then I had always become interested in medical subjects, you know, from my friends at university who were doing medicine. And at university, I became aware, because I previously wasn't aware, that natural therapies even existed. I can remember I was about 19 looking at the bulletin board at the university, and someone was advertising a talk on natural medical therapies. And I thought, what? Well, you know, I've not heard of this. Age of 19, never heard of it. So that tweaked my interest. And so I started, while I was still working as a scientist, I started studying natural therapies in Australia at a very prominent naturopathic college there. But then I was doing night school, but then they went over to daytime classes, and I thought, well, I had some advice from someone who said, well, if you're going to give up your job to study this, why just limit yourself to Australia? So I found this course that really suited me in the United Kingdom that specialized in both herbs and medicine. You know, it was a medical herbalist course and totally unique at the time. And half the subjects we did were medicine, the other half herbs. An example is the herb chamomile. In Materia Medica, we did 9 hours of lectures on just chamomile. And you're talking here, by then it was the early 1980s, but you're talking here before so much science was being generated. But nonetheless, we went into this extraordinary detail. We looked at its use across cultures around the world. We looked at its quality aspects, its phytochemistry. And it was incredibly detailed education. It is exactly what I wanted. So when I came back, and you know, my lecturer, or the Heinz Elstra, the main teacher at that college, was interested in manufacturing. And with my chemistry background, I was interested in manufacturing. So when I came back to Australia, I wasn't happy with the quality of the herbs that were being made. And that time it was all liquids. You know, we take the liquids and we blend them together. So I started making my own, much to my wife's horror, in her laundry, or our laundry. And just to show I'm a modern male, I do washing as well. Now I wash clothes as well, so her laundry, I shouldn't have said that. Anyway. And I was, at the time, I just started teaching in a naturopathic college, and some of the you know, the lecturers, fellow lecturers said, oh, we hear you're making our products for your practice. Do you want to try a few with it? Sell us some of them. And so I did, and they really liked them, and they were produced in a unique way. So I used a percolation technology and not the standard percolation technology. And it really was quite a unique way to both preserve the good phytochemical balance of what was in the herb, but make something was potent that you could deliver therapeutic doses. Because at the time, I was observing around the world among Western herbalists, I felt very much they were underdosing. And part of that was based on the preparations that they were using. So then a group of business people who were looking at business ideas backed my wife and I into a business, and MediHerb was born, and we started percolating our first product in December 1986. So we're getting on to 33 years old.
That's impressive. And I love that your kind of search for the gold standard, or having such a high standard of herbal products, was, you know, part of your quest of creating your own company. Whereas, you know, there's still subpar quality products out there today. Yes. All everywhere. Yes. So,
well, it kind of happened by accident. I'm in my nature more of an academic and educator. So it kind of happened by accident that a company started. I just wanted to use good product for my patients. And when I started out, I had just one simple objective, you know, that if one person's health could be helped in a meaningful way, then, you know, giving up my job as a research scientist, my wife giving up a job as a primary school teacher, and traveling to another, selling everything up, traveling to another country, it would have all been worthwhile. And I have to say that personally, that objective has been fulfilled so many times over, but it's also been multiplied now because people are using the products that MediHerb makes and are making an absolutely real difference in people's lives.
That is the truth. I actually started using MediHerb as a patient in 1999, so 20 years ago. And I remember the exact moment that I first tasted the Eleutherococcus tincture, Siberian ginseng, for people who don't know what the Latin name is. And my naturopath had it on his desk, had the, you know, 200 milliliter bottle on his desk, and said, here, try a little bit of this, taste this. I'm going to prescribe it to you, but I want to see if you like the taste first. And I love the taste.
It does have a nice taste, that herb. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Unlike what a lot of people think of herbal medicines, you know, that's kind of, you know, bitter or having a acrid taste or different tastes that are not what people are used to because everybody's so addicted to sugar today. So for me, that was kind of my first experience with MediHerb tinctures. And then in the herbal sciences program, we had a lot of medicine making lab time, and there were a lot of MediHerb tinctures in the lab, and I would try to taste all of them pretty much by the end of the, you know, 6 or 9 months of the year. So that was kind of my introduction. So MediHerb has always been, in my mind, the pinnacle of excellence and quality in the world of botanical medicine. And a lot of patients are buying stuff online today on Amazon or just wherever they can online for, you know, going for the most affordable price and not really understanding what the quality issues are. Maybe this could be a good segue into one of the questions that we had before we started today. Is somebody was asking about how to look for quality herbal medicine products, you know, what are the kind of certificates of analysis that you should look for, or processes or questions that maybe you should call and ask the company about?
Look, it's a complex and question to answer. But essentially, perhaps I could just go back slightly and say MediHerb is a professional only brand. And the obvious reason behind that is that it's what I knew. I'm a healthcare professional, so I wanted to give my colleagues, you know, the best opportunity to get results with their patients. So, So the first thing to, I think, acknowledge is that a company that is professional only, it basically its commercial success has to be based on quality. If you look at a retail company, they can follow fads and, you know, and because there's so many people who might buy their product, use it once and find it doesn't work, it doesn't matter because there's someone else new who's going to buy that product and use it. So the whole, if you like, business model of a retail company isn't necessarily that reliant on quality. But the business model of a professional only company, and there are very few out there in the herbal space, and particularly in the US, if the product isn't the optimal quality and therefore the doctor doesn't get a result with that patient, two things happen. The doctor might lose that patient. That's the first potential. But the second potential is that the doctor might go out of business because they're not developing a reputation that they help people with their health. So you can see clearly, you know, just from a pure business model perspective, to be highly successful as a pure practitioner business, as a pure doctor business, you have to base it on quality. So where does quality start? Well, it starts at the growing level. So there's a thing called good agricultural practice, and then goes to the drying and processing. That's the drying is part of good agricultural practice. And then it goes to good manufacturing practice at the factory. Now, good manufacturing practice has various...
I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space, where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
Layers. So the company should be operating the highest layer, which is pharmaceutical GMP or good manufacturing practice. But with herbs, because they're from nature and they're biological agents and hence are inherently variable and carry with them a history, you know, we all have a history in our lives, living things have a history. Because they have a history, it's important that you actually go higher than good manufacturing practices. And so you need a team of dedicated scientists who are phytochemists, who are analytical chemists, who understand the complexity of dealing with this, with these highly variable therapeutic agents. And so, you know, does the company have its own labs? Yeah, third-party testing is okay, and certainly can be done. And has been done. We do it, for example, where needed. But I think the main thing is, what's the capacity of the company in-house to do this? What's its level of expertise? How many, you know, herbal practitioners, phytochemists, and so on does it have on staff? What about the processes they use? You know, when, for example, when Medihub makes a product, is very conscious of preserving that phytochemical integrity. So we test the raw herb. The raw herb must meet certain specifications. That then goes into extraction. And then that liquid extract we first produce must meet certain specifications. That might then be sold to practitioners or blend it together, or it might be then further processed into a tablet form. And again, what losses or not occur along that way. So it's testing, testing, testing it, multiple stages in the manufacture. And because plants carry a history, you want to know about that history. So you're testing for heavy metals, you're testing for pesticides. Everyone knows about these, but not everyone tests regularly. But then you also need to test for other herbal contaminants. And we have this problem now that's growing where there are the toxic alkaloids called pyrrolizidine alkaloids that occur in some weeds, and they're being harvested with the herb and contaminating the herb with potential toxins. So you need, for example, a company that has the awareness that this is an issue ahead of the game, and B, the company is actually, you know, bringing that into reality with a testing program. So there's some examples. I think you need, and pharmaceutical GMP is not fully required in the US yet. Certainly the FDA under the DSHEA laws has lifted the standard to high levels of GMP, but we get inspected by the FDA as well as the Australian authorities, and the Australian authorities inspect to a pharmaceutical standard, whereas the FDA don't quite inspect to that standard. It's more of a, well, it's a dietary supplement standard, which is lower than pharmaceutical. So I think it's important to be at the level of pharmaceutical GMP. Then you can also get information about a herbal product from its label. So many herbal products, for example, don't put the plant part on. And in the US, you allow this concept of proprietary blends. So proprietary blend of 15 different herbs. You don't know how much is there of each one. I mean, as a professional, I would never dream of prescribing that to someone. And therefore, as a consumer, the same standard, I think, would apply. Well, why would you take it when you don't really know what's in it? You know the herbs there, or you don't know, how much of what's in it. So no plant part specification, to me, is a common error. They don't describe how much, whether it's there as a dried herb, whether it's there as the extract. So there's not full disclosure on labels. And that, to me, shows the knowledge of the company and also how quality focused they are if that information is missing on the label.
Yeah, that's something that I actually haven't even thought about for a while, because I don't use those formulations with my patients or with myself. So that's a really valid point. Also, the one thing I really like about MediHerbs extractions, the liquids, is the ratios. So yes. Maybe you can speak to that. What's a 1-to-1 ratio, a 1-to-2 ratio? That
okay. So you're dealing with the dried herb and the amount of liquid that was used to make it. So you take a herb like peppermint. You know, it's a leaf. It's a dried leaf. So if you said, look, I'm going to make a 1-in-2, and it's metric, a 1-in-2 peppermint leaf product. So 1 kilo of peppermint into 2 liters of final product. If you just use the normal soaking process and you add the 2 liters to the 1 kilo of dried peppermint, you come back later and you find, there's no liquid there at all because the herb has soaked it all up. So your product is zero. You might be able to press some of that liquid back out, but not all of it. But you get a tiny, tiny yield. And so what happens when companies want to make, therefore, using a soaking process, which is called maceration, they take that 1 kilo and they mix it typically with about 5 liters. So, and they're called tinctures. So generally what's available in liquid form in the marketplace are tinctures. So when I was in the UK, there was a strong movement back to tinctures from more concentrated extracts, because more concentrated extracts were being made by processes that damaged that delicate phytochemical balance. So you can see why they wanted to move to a weaker product, but a product that was more highly preserved of what was in the original starting material. You can see that, understand that movement. But instead of then adjusting their doses and saying, hey, I'm using a 1-in-5, it maybe is 5 times weaker than a 1-in-1, on at least on face value, So I might need to up my doses a bit. They kept using the same doses. And I come to this point that a lot of Western herbalists at that time, and even now, were underdosing for the herbs. So what I did with my interest in herbal manufacture is I looked at techniques of percolation. So with percolation, what you do is you pack the herb in a long, long column. It's not percolation like coffee percolation. It's a particular pharmaceutical technique. You pack the herb in a long, long column and you drop liquid in the top and drip, 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 drip down, soaking up the active components as it works its way down that long column, and you collect it at the bottom. And that way you can, using modifications that are proprietary and unique that I develop based on my chemistry knowledge, you can reasonably, you know, to a high level, to more than 90%, extract what's in that 1 kilo of herb and have that there in the 2 liters that you collect in the bottom. So you can make a much stronger extract, but one that preserves the phytochemical balance that is so much needed. And so it was like having the best of both worlds. It was like having a really strong extract for high doses, but one that preserved, like a tincture, all of the original balance of phytochemicals. So that's how our liquids are made. We have lots and lots of big, tall percolators, and we use that process. We call it cold percolation, just to, it's not that people are running around in Eskimo suits or anything like that. We call it cold percolation because most people, when they think percolation, they think coffee percolators, so they think heat. So heat's not applied in that process. And the process occurs over 10 days. So it's a very, very slow extraction process to get everything out.
And heat would be damaging, correct, to the herbs? And there are some extraction processes that people are still using heat for syrups and things like that.
Yes. Look, sometimes you have to use heat, but certain herbs are, you know, have volatiles. They're quite damaged by heat. So generally you really avoid it. And if you do use a small amount of heat, like maybe up to 40, 50 degrees centigrade in, for example, a tableting process, it's very brief. So you don't necessarily damage the herb. But what was happening, and this caused this reaction in the UK at the time, is they were getting the herb and they were boiling it down to make it concentrated in open vats and boiling it. So, you know, close to 100 degrees centigrade. Now, sometimes we do use heat where the active components are not damaged and where we're going to a different option. So the example of that is kava. So kava extracts were originally extracted, and still are, with alcohol and water. But the concerns arose that that might have been connected to this sporadic sort of liver damage. So rare but sporadic liver damage. And that tainted the reputation of kava. So when we were looking at addressing that problem, we were looking at the situation of traditional use where they extracted it with water. But water is not a good solvent unless it's hot. So you want to get these kava lactones that have the beneficial effects of the kava. So we ended up doing hot water extraction, got good levels of lactones out, but prepared it, if you like, in a traditional way, which was the water extract. And you know, liver damage from its traditional use is virtually unheard of. And so thereby mitigated any health risk associated with the kava. So occasionally heat can be an ally, but generally it's to be avoided.
That's a really good share there about the kava. And I love the kava forte, the tablets that MediHerb makes. And they're, I mean, it's really the best kava I've ever used. I've actually have some cases where patients have been able to get off sleeping pills like Ambien with just using 1 to 2 tablets and then eventually just a half a tablet of kava before bed. And that was really all they needed.
It is certainly my personal go-to for jet lag. You know, it really helps me get to sleep. The other thing I take for jet lag, which might surprise people, is chase tree. I also take a tonic blend of herbs, you know, just to help with the stresses of jet lag, and particularly with resveratrol, grape seed extract, and ginkgo, all of that helps in that ginseng and that tonic blend. That's called herbivital. I take that, but a chaste tree I take because it helps with your natural melatonin release, and I find that incredibly beneficial. But you still need to get to sleep in the first place, so that's where the kava comes in. So that combination of those three different things has transformed. You know, my international travel is not nearly as bad and as stressful as it used to be, in terms of, you know, trying to give all day lectures when you've only had a few hours sleep. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. Touch wood.
That's great. Yeah, the idea or the concept of using chaste tree berry. I mean, I remember first learning about chaste tree berry extracts in botanical medicine, and I think in the medieval ages in Europe, they were calling it monk's pepper because the monks yes. would put it on their food so they have no libido.
Yes.
And I remember sharing that I was using chaste tree berry on someone else's podcast after I got back from Australia to the States and dealing with, you know, getting 3.5 hours of sleep on a 17-hour yes, flight so to Seattle.
You had a personal experience of jet lag, yes.
Yeah, and the chaste tree berry helped a lot. I mean, I was also taking echinacea and some other things because, unfortunately, I got some bronchitis on my travels. But yeah, I digress. So
planes are disease incubators, basically.
Yeah, they're horrible.
Long-haul flights, yeah.
And I mean, you're still traveling around the world and speaking, so that's spectacular that combination is still working for you.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I rely on it. I find it very difficult to do now if I didn't. So you're saying you were taking the chaste tree. Did someone comment with surprise when you told
them? Yes, someone said that they thought, wow, that must have really killed your libido. And my kind of reply was, well, I wasn't really concerned about a libido when I was trying to get back to
yes.
my time zone for, you know, that first week back. So,
yeah. Yeah. Look, my experience with male patients giving chaste tree, and I do recommend it for their sleep, you know, not just for jet lag people, but just to help with this, sleep maintenance, because if you're producing melatonin, you'll stay asleep, you'll have less awakenings when you can't get back to sleep, all of that sort of thing. My experience is that at the kind of doses that are needed, which is of the order of about 2 to 3 grams a day of original chaste tree starting material, which is the berry, that the effects on libido are generally mild in most men, if at all.
That's good to know, verify
it's that. It's not that potent, you know. It's funny because, I was giving a lecture once and I said, I can imagine, you know, the modern woman, she's got a supply of tribulus on the one hand and chaste tree on the other, and when she's in the mood, she feeds her partner. Which is not in the mood, she feeds him chaste tree, but they're not that fast acting, I think, to work in that way.
Right, yeah, that's funny. Just to make sure, yeah, calm them down a little bit. We had a lot of questions, and one of the ones that I really wanted to get your expertise on was, there's this debate in the kind of men's health, testosterone community, longevity community, around using metformin.
Michael J. for Hope for the Warriors. Started back in 06 at Camp Lejeune. Military families witnessing the effects of war on their loved ones. Now, almost 20 years later, they've aided over 53,000 service members, veterans, and families with confidential, high-quality behavioral health care services at little or no cost to post 9/11 vets and their families. Over 91% of every dollar donated goes directly to the programs. If you're as concerned about our heroes as I am, go to hopeforthewarriors.org. Michael J. for Hope for the Warriors. Started back in 06 at Camp Lejeune. Military families witnessing the effects of war on their loved ones. Now, almost 20 years later, they've aided over 53,000 service members, veterans, and families with confidential, high-quality behavioral health care services at little or no cost to post-9/11 vets and their families. Over 91% of every dollar donated goes directly to the programs. If you're as concerned about our heroes as I am, go to hopeforthewarriors.org.
Versus using berberine extracts for insulin resistance and longevity. And I know you gave a lengthy talk about this in Oakland, as well as when I was in Australia, about how berberine works on mTOR and all those kind of pathways.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious what your take is on that, since you're, you know, the expert.
Well, berberine, and we should also add in resveratrol, the phytochemical resveratrol as well at this point, they basically act on AMPK. And if you upregulate this AMP kinase, AMPK, in the cell, then you get a whole lot of metabolic effects where the cell goes more into energy burning rather than energy storing. So more, the cell becomes more anabolic rather than catabolic. And that really helps balance metabolism. And a lot of that is also mediated at mitochondrial level, for example. So berberine, resveratrol are natural targets for AMPK. Now, what has been serendipitously discovered with metformin and its use for type 2 diabetes is that it also is an AMPK target. And people who've been taking metformin for their type 2 diabetes have a lower mortality rate than people with type 2 diabetes taking other medication. And it's thought because specifically of the beneficial effects on AMPK. So downstream, AMPK has a number of effects. As you say, it lowers mTOR C1, but it also upregulates this factor called PGC1-alpha, which is involved in mitochondrial health and regulation. And it also upregulates mitophagy, which is the turnover of your faulty mitochondria. So it's hugely beneficial. It's also antifibrotic, and I'm going to touch on a really interesting theory that about AMPK and ovarian cancer that's just come through in the literature. So the question is, well, do I, you know, upregulate AMPK, especially in this modern age of underexercise and overnutrition, is valuable. So do I take metformin or do I take berberine in its natural herbal source? And my argument is that, well, metformin is a pharmaceutical drug. You know, it is a synthetic. It's a semi-synthetic. Funnily enough, metformin has its origins in the phytochemical galangal, which is found in the herb goat's rue, which was a traditional herbal treatment for diabetics. So in the 1920s, they got the galangal and they phytochemically modified it and made metformin. But so it's semi-synthetic, but it does have that synthetic component. And I believe that because it's a drug of natural origin, at least, that's probably why it does have some longevity benefits, but it's still a drug. It's still got that synthetic aspect to its personality too. And therefore, I think it's an anathema to say that we have to take drugs to maintain health. You know, nature has provided everything we need to optimize and maintain health. It's a different story if you've got disease, and then you might need drugs. But to maintain health, to me, it goes totally against principles to be taking a drug to optimize and maintain health. And I think woe betide our societies if that's the way we go. And the simple reason is this: that drugs are not subtle. They interact strongly with a person's biochemistry and they have unwanted pathway effects. And they're already seeing a few of these for metformin. And I think one particular study was showing that metformin in conjunction with exercise dampened the beneficial effects of exercise, a recent study. The other thing is, if you're taking a drug to optimize health, you've got to take it every day. And therefore, what you're doing by taking it every day, you're accentuating its side effect, its unwanted effects on your physiology over time. Now, I'm not saying natural plant chemicals are totally free of that aspect, but they're far less likely to do so because we have evolved with them. And when I say we, I mean animal life has evolved with them. And we share a lot of the common genetic features of our animal ancestors. So we have an inherent compatibility with plant-based chemicals, especially the ones that are non-toxic. So in my argument, anything that we're taking long-term to optimize health that delivers the same benefits as a drug, you're going to choose the natural option. And that's why, in a long-winded way, I suggest berberine is preferable to metformin. There's even a school of thought, not necessarily in the case of berberine, but certainly in the case of many dietary phytochemicals, and resveratrol will come in here, that the body is actually tuned to operate properly only in their presence. Because in the earlier diets that we had, they were so abundant, it made sense, I guess, from a survival perspective for the body to say, hey, I don't need to produce all these factors to make sure these different pathways work well because they're coming in through the diet. So I'll let those dietary ones trigger all those mechanisms and have those benefits. So what's happened now, we have this incredible mismatch of what you might say is Stone Age genes with modern lifestyle. And so we've all become, in my view, phytochemically deficient. So that's a side discussion, but to me, it argues strongly that phytochemicals have the answer when we're looking for healthy aging and healthy longevity.
I love that term that I don't know if I've heard you say it before, but phytochemically deficient.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I think that could be a whole, you know, book or chapter in a book and, you know, several podcasts. We could talk about that forever, basically. But looking at, you know, what people are truly deficient in their food and their spices, lack of spices.
Yeah. Well, to me, case in point, you go to India, and as I have recently, the hot, spicy food, they're getting this abundance of phytochemicals that is missing from the Western diet. And what do you see? That despite the high incidence of type 2 diabetes in India, the vascular effects, especially the effects on the eyes and the kidneys and the nerves, you know, the microangiopathy, as it's called, the fine blood vessel disease that occurs with type 2 diabetes, is half what it is in the West, because all these phytochemicals, which generally tend to benefit the microcirculation, are compensating for it. So to me, it's that, and if you look at this area, it is being very well researched and acknowledged. They're using the term phytonutrient. They're even suggesting, you know, recommended daily intakes for flavonoids now and for certain carotenoids like lutein. So it's all happening at that scientific level of this recognition under the banner of phytonutrients that people are phytochemically deficient.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because there's a lot of kind of recommended or, you know, mega doses of vitamins recommended in the natural health space. But there's not, I think, enough talk about this phytochemically deficient modern person.
Yes. Yes.
It's just, you know, we talk about, you know, for example, vitamin D. I'm here in Seattle, Washington, and you know, the northern latitudes, and, you know, they've even said in San Diego and Florida, people are vitamin D deficient. So we talk about
that. Yeah, I've seen the movies, vampires live up your way because there's so little sunlight.
I'm sure they do. I try to stay away. There's definitely not enough sunlight here. I'm jealous of you and everybody in Queensland. It's an amazing climate to live in, I think. I actually moved here from Arizona, so
Oh, wow. Yes. So, yeah. You can understand that. Yeah. So before I forget, just that little take on ovarian cancer and AMPK. So if you upregulate AMPK, you also reduce the tendency of cells to produce too much fibrosis, you know, laying down of excess connective tissue during a healing phase, you know. And for example, liver fibrosis is what leads to cirrhosis. We know endometriosis is too much fibrosis happens in the abdominal cavity. And there's now this theory about ovarian cancer that due to poor regulation of AMPK, the when the woman ovulates, the production of the egg having to work its way through more excessive. See, each time an egg is produced, there's kind of a healing process that happens in the ovary. And if you've got a tendency to produce too much fibrosis, you produce too much fibrous tissue in that egg at each point in ovulation. So eventually you get to the point that at ovulation, the egg kind of has to work its way through too much fibrotic tissue, and that creates an inflammatory response. And as we know, prolonged inflammatory responses eventually lead to cancer. So there's a school of thought now suggesting that if we upregulate AMPK in women, that their risk of ovarian cancer will go down because they're producing less fibrous tissue in the ovary. It's quite an interesting and fascinating theory.
That's fascinating.
They're advocating metformin in that context, but I'm thinking, well, why not berberine in that context?
And then you're talking about HervaVital. Well, HervaVital, one of the herbs in HervaVital, we could use HervaVital with berberine for these women and these men to kind of optimize, is kind of what I'm hearing.
AMPK.
Yeah, AMPK.
Optimize AMPK. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I'm curious to go back to your point about the recent research of metformin basically inhibiting the benefits of exercise at the mitochondrial level. I did see there's a New York Times kind of like put out their headline on that article. And there was a lot of buzz about that in the communities where they're really big fans of metformin. And now they're just saying, just don't take it when you exercise. But we could just take berberine when we exercise. And does berberine have that same negative effect?
Not as we know it. Not as we know it. It may, but I suspect not, because I think that's possibly a different pathway of metformin. It's not necessarily an AMPK-mediated pathway. We need to understand more, but I would suspect not. But here's the point. I think it also highlights that when we talk about phytonutrients or phytochemicals, we're talking about a suite of inputs. We're not talking about a single input. And this has been emphasized now in a lot of research and good research coming out of China in particular, of this concept of network pharmacology, in that rather than having one single chemical agent that has a big blocking effect or just a big promoting effect on one pathway, you instead looking at this whole pathway and doing subtle interventions all the way along. So you get a network effect that's not as disruptive to the normal physiology of the body. So you still see an outcome, and often a profound outcome, but you haven't along the way paid the price of a disruption to the normal physiology. And that's again comes back to phytonutrients. I believe our body is actually hardwired to receive these subtle network pharmacology based phytonutrient signals, and you know, at one stage I'm hoping that the powers that be in Big Pharma or wherever wake up to this, that there is this inherent superiority of using the herb in the plant as opposed to as an isolated chemical. You know, we're going to flip the whole basis that led to modern drug development, which was, hey, people take opium and they get these certain effects, or let's isolate morphine, or people take coca leaf and let's isolate cocaine. So we go back to the use of the whole plant, particularly when we're looking at therapeutic outcomes. And that was even highlighted by some research out of Africa that showed that the pure chemical artemisinin couldn't help these people with resistant malaria, But when they gave them the Artemisia annua extract that had the artemisinin in them, their malaria was resolved. So there has to be some other aspects from using it in its totality. And as I said, these hardwired responses of the body to the network pharmacology signals from a multitude of phytochemicals in their totality. And that's where it comes back to herbal quality. You always want to preserve that totality throughout the process.
Yeah, I like the topic around this kind of synergistic approach or synergistic actions at the biochemical level in the body with the phytochemistry of plants.
Yeah, look, it's a different concept to synergy, though. I think synergy is often misguidedly.
Right.
I mean, synergy means you have two things together and their combined effect is more than additive. And that certainly does occur. But here it's more where you're looking at multiple points. So, but you're looking at a single point of intervention for synergy. Here you're looking at multiple points in a pathway. So the network pharmacology better describes it.
Network pharmacology.
There often is synergy involved as well.
Right. And then with kind of getting onto the topic more of men's hormone health,
yes.
Switching gears, I'm curious. I mean, I'm a big fan of herbs like ashwagandha and Korean ginseng, et cetera, but I would like to get your input on what, if you could pick maybe 3 to 5 herbs for the sake of time, what would be your top 3 to 5 herbs that you look at for optimizing men's testosterone and longevity? And I would also throw in, somebody was asking about muscle health in my Facebook group, so I'm curious. I know that's a lot with a little bit of time.
No, it's good. So I think certainly for muscle health, the research we have so far is strongly with ashwagandha. There have been clinical data. It's shown anabolic activity in animal models. And we know that it does elevate testosterone via elevating DHEA in men. So ashwagandha, but it's got to be a decent dose, you know, if at least 4 gram herb equivalent, maybe even higher per day. And that's that. When I say herb, I mean the proper plant part, which in this case is root, in fact. I think there's good suggestion from a lot of the other tonic and adaptogenic herbs that they have properties in that way. So you've mentioned Korean ginseng. I think Korean ginseng is a good herb for healthy longevity for anyone. I mean, the Chinese revered it in that way. I take it on a daily basis myself, not at a high dose, but I take some every day. So Korean ginseng would be another. Even Eleuthero-Siberian ginseng, you mentioned, I think has activity there. Rhodiola. Now, a lot of these adaptogenic herbs, particularly rhodiola, Korean ginseng, we're now understanding they act on mitochondrial health. So muscle tissue, of course, apart from some specialized tissue like the ovum and what have you, but generally muscle tissue has the highest density of mitochondria because of the work, physical work it has to do. So anything that impacts on mitochondrial health will be beneficial for muscle health. So I mentioned this term previously, PGC1-alpha. So you upregulate AMPK, you upregulate PGC1-alpha. So there are 3 key phytonutrient pathways, or not phytonutrient, yeah, phytonutrient-influenced pathways that upregulate PGC1-alpha and impact muscle health. So the first is the AMPK pathway, which we've just described. So berberine, resveratrol, impact there. And then we have the sirtuin-1 pathway, which is a key healthy longevity pathway, and resveratrol impacts there. And then we have another pathway, which is a cellular protective pathway called the NRF2 pathway. It also upregulates PGC1-alpha. And there are many herbs that upregulate PGC1-alpha, but ginseng does it, Korean ginseng, as we've discussed. Ginkgo does it. Turmeric and curcumin do garlic does. So there's a range of herbs. Did I mention ginkgo? I'm not sure I did. The range of herbs that can. Rosemary is a particularly good one at impact pathway. So there's this village in Italy where, you know, there's this centenarians, 10% of the population are 100 or older. And they're incredibly fit and healthy and have good muscle tone. And it's because they have so much rosemary. Well, that's what's attributed to in their diet. So there is that that benefit that way. If we talk about PGC1 alpha, which I'm mentioning as being impacted by those three different phytonutrient influence pathways, PGC1 alpha, there was a study done at an Australian university, and they looked at people who were training to become peak athletes. And of course, you can train all you like. Some people just don't get to peak performance. Others do, some do. And when they studied to find what the difference was, it was their genetically predetermined capacity to upregulate PGC1 alpha in response to exercise. Those that were good at doing it got peak performance. Those who weren't didn't. And yet here we have, as I said, three key pathways that phytonutrients can upregulate PGC1 alpha. So, you know, to me, that's where the interest should certainly lie when you look at muscle health and athletic performance.
So to recap, we have rosemary that works there, Korean ginseng, and you mentioned ashwagandha with
resveratrol. Resveratrol, Korean, you mentioned already Korean ginseng. So they look on the face of the current knowledge. There's another herb which is acknowledged as a male tonic and has certainly been used by people, athletes, and people, you know, in gyms, and that's tribulus. But if you're using tribulus, make sure you're using a product with tribulus leaf. Tribulus is often substituted with other plant parts like the fruit or the root, but all the research about the male health aspects of tribulus come from tribulus leaf. And as our research showed, not just tribulus leaf from anywhere, because it grows all around the world, it's just a weed, but tribulus leaf out of Eastern Europe has a unique phytochemical profile, and that's where all this Bulgarian and so on research was done. And therefore, you need to match that. And I think this is really important when people see about research on a herb. You know, the questions I'm automatically asking are, well, what was the dose used? What's the phytochemical constituents from that herb? What was the plant part? All of these questions need to be answered. And unless you match all those, you're not going to reproduce the results of that research.
Yeah, that seems to be a common theme where people don't know which plant part to use, and as you already mentioned in the beginning, they're not using the correct dose, so right there they're starting off and setting themselves up for failure.
Yes, and of course these days it's compounded by Dr. Google and what have you, and everyone's their own doctor, you know.
Oh yeah.
Everyone's their own doctor, or their friend is their doctor. So I have a story to tell you about that. So I had a patient who had a very serious disease, a life-threatening disease. And one day she rang me up actually. And one day she said, I don't need to see you anymore. I found the answer. And I said, oh, right. Okay. Yes. I was talking to my hairdresser and she showed me this website where the answer to my health problems relies in some very simple dietary things that she needed to do, you know, which would of course done nothing. But it's all there on the website. It's the cure. So I don't need to see you anymore. So I was quite gracious and I said to her, well, I'm still here if you need me. So yeah, try it and see how you go and get back to me if you need me. What I would like to have said to her is, oh, no, keep coming to see me because I can try cutting your hair. And,
you're right.
And put it in that contrast, it kind of, well, yeah. I'm not going to let my herbalist cut my hair, but hey, I'll get herbal advice from my hairdresser. You know, what's going on?
Yeah, that is,
It's amazing how much you can probably speak to this, given the fact that you've been practicing for almost four decades here now and been really deep in the industry in a lot of aspects, but how the landscape of practicing has changed so much, you know, thanks to the internet, which is a double-edged sword. You know, there's a lot of good things, but
it's a tool. It's a tool, and like any tool, we need to understand its limitations. So in the old days, you know, people come to see me and I say, now I think you need echinacea. And they say, euthanasia? What's that? But in the old days, we had the uninformed patient.
Right.
We have the misinformed patient. And honestly, it can take so much time and effort just to undo a lot of and it's only because they saw it on a website. So the answer, I think, to every doctor out there who doesn't want to deal with misinformed patients is get your own website and put your own info out there. I haven't yet done it personally, but it's on my agenda at my young age to do so.
Right. Yeah, it does. The pre-education is massive that needs to happen with people. And I mean, that's one of my missions of this podcast is to help pre-educate everybody's patients and, you know, just get some basic information that most people, you know, it gets tiring and exhausting saying the same things to hundreds of people every year. And then if they don't get it, the risk isn't so much just them not staying on as a patient, but what's going to happen to their health if they already have two autoimmune diseases and then they're headed towards cancer, cardiovascular disease, or both.
Yes.
And then early preventable death. So I think a lot of people think that they're immortal and that they have a lot of time that they don't have. And unfortunately, the statistics say otherwise. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think that misinformation, you know, it's not just about herbs and supplements. It's very strong with diet these days too. So I have a joke that I'm going to establish this new fad diet I'm going to create, which is the diet, which is I'm going to justify the way I would really like to eat diet by making false health claims about it. Diet.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure that diet will be very popular.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of people are already on the train doing that diet out there. Yeah, I mean, it is amazing what the human mind will condition or convince itself is okay for their habits or addictions or what have you.
Yes, absolutely.
With botanical medicine and, you know, what are some things that you think could be really helpful for people maybe that kind of on the note of addiction or trying to stop smoking, or, I mean, obviously treating multifactorial, and I've seen things like acupuncture.
Yeah, I might pass on that one because we're out of it.
Yeah.
And we're almost out of time. Yeah. It's a difficult question to answer. And also I'm a little bit concerned about, you know, the regulatory implications of what I might say.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. We'll have to talk about that privately then.
Yes.
On that note, I think we are almost out of time here. What are some parting thoughts you might have to share with everybody? And then I have a quick question. In the next 12 months, are you coming back to the U.S. or speaking in
Absolutely. Australia? So that's an easy one. Yes, I am coming back to the US in September. Is September, late September, early October is the plan. We're not sure about specific dates and venues yet, but that's definitely in my calendar. And so easy question to answer that one. The other one, final closing thoughts. I think that it's like any herbs, the use of herbs for health is like any complex field. You know, you need to find someone you can trust using products that you know you can rely on that deliver not just good quality for that one batch you're using now, but have the systems in place to deliver that batch to batch consistency from time to time. And if you find those, if you get the right advice about what to use and then use the right product with the consistency of quality, then you will be amazed at what herbs can do for your health.
Spectacular. Yeah. I mean, herbal medicine has definitely changed my life, and I know it's helped a lot of my patients. So thank you for all of your time, and thanks for everything you've shared with everybody today.
And thanks, Sam.
I really appreciate it immensely, because I know how busy you are and all the things that you're up to. So, or at least some of them anyway. So thanks very much. And I look forward to seeing you again next year when you come back to the States, and then hopefully again someday in Australia. So
Yes, it'd be great. Either way, looking forward to seeing you soon.
Yes, likewise.
Yeah.
All right. Well, everybody, please share the podcast with friends and family. And we look forward to hearing your feedback. And we'll be back on the next show to share more information with you about how you can optimize your health.
Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.